Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We are here until 5 o'clock. It is a Tuesday morning, and it's 2 for Tuesday, so get your requests in now. And that is one artist, two songs, so get your requests in now. We'll play them in a little bit. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text and those requests. Coming up a little bit later on, we are going to be talking about the career of John Singleton, for sure, and we're talking about the new Impossible Burger at Burger King, plus some really weird fast food menu items that are available. But as you heard, that was just Prince, 1999. There is a new book that has come out that is written by Brian Raftery, and it is called Best Movie Year Ever, How 1999 Blew Up the Big Screen. And 1999 was an extraordinary year for movie releases. And some incredible movies came out and some real game changers. And it's often looked back upon, you know, 20 years later as one of the best movie years of all time. And I'm very glad that somebody wrote a book about it, because it's you know, cinephiles have often gone back to 1999 and said, just wow, look at the list of the movies that came out that year. And Brian Raftery has written a book about it, and it's a really great book with tons of great reviews and history about the movies themselves, and great interviews with people like Edward Norton and Steven Soderbergh, Matthew Broderick, David Fincher, M. Night Shyamalan, and it goes on and on and on. And it details in chronological order the releases of some of the most important movies of 1999. It's a terrific book. We want to welcome Brian to the show. Brian, how are you?
I'm good, Nick. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So you've been writing for a long time. Tell me how you got into the writing business and the entertainment writing.
Gosh, it's been a long time now. Back when they used to have a lot of magazines,
yeah.
I started working at Entertainment Weekly, actually, as an intern in 1999, which was pretty great timing to work at a place like that where you're basically surrounded by some of the smartest movie nerds in the world, and you're living in New York and going to these movies either on opening night or at screening. So, like, I was kind of plunged right into the 1999 movies as it was happening, as I was just out of college, which was a pretty exciting time to be going to see, being John Malkovich and Three Kings and Election and Fight Club right in New York City. It was a pretty spectacular year. Even at the time, it felt pretty special.
Yeah, no, it did. And I've been reviewing movies here at WGN since 1985. And, you know, you go back in time and look at, like, your favorite movies of the year. You look at your top 10 lists or things like that. And, man, seriously, 1999 just stands out. Was there something in the air, you think, Brian?
I think, you know, it's funny. You can look at it as coincidence, like, oh, all these interesting kind of game-changing movies came at once, and it just happened to happen. But I really do think that it's more fun to look at sort of the end of the 90s and kind of what was going on. And I feel like it was kind of a collision of things. One is that, you know, the big studios were in a little bit of trouble at the end of the 90s. They were doing fine commercially, but creatively, they were really getting locked into a lot of TV adaptations. They were making movies like Lost in Space and The Odd Couple 2 and all these movies we've all kind of forgotten about now.
Yeah.
And I think some of the executives kind of realized that as that was happening, there was a lot of really exciting voices and movements going on in sort of in independent film and in music videos and in commercials. And so you have this really big talent pool. You have the studio system, which is really interested in making new things. And at the same time, you have this weird, kind of strange Y2K hanging over the whole last half of the decade. And you know, I interviewed 130 people for this book.
Yeah.
None of them said, oh, I was thinking about Y2K every day. But when you look at how these movies were kind of addressing a lot of big issues, like, I mean, even a great comedy like Office Space is basically an existential crisis about a guy who realizes how unhappy he is and kind of tries to upend his life. I think you have a lot of interesting kind of social and commercial factors that made this year possible.
Yeah.
It could have been a coincidence too, but that's less fun.
No, that's right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's you know, you talk about how for people who remember what, you know, the late 90s were like, especially as we got closer to the year 2000, you know, the whole Y2K thing was massive and big, and it loomed over everything. And you open the book with this insane story with involving Brad Pitt, David Fincher in Mexico. it kind of sums up the anxiety that people were feeling at that time. And tell everybody, maybe not ruin the story, but it's such a crazy and really, really funny story and a really terrific way to open up the book. Tell me a little bit about how you heard about that story.
Well, those two guys, so David Fincher, the director, and Brad Pitt, the actor, I don't need to introduce who he is, but they had just made Fight Club. It had just come out. It had not been a big hit at the time. So they were spending New Year's Eve in Mexico on a private beach with a bunch of friends, and it was pretty much them with just a few other people, and at midnight, all the lights went out, and these sort of local cops showed up and wound up taking away one of their friends into the back of a car and driving down an abandoned road. Fincher and Pitt are kind of known for their pranks. You can kind of guess how this story ends,
yeah.
But it really was that whole night sort of captures this whole kind of feeling that we all had in the 90s, which is like we're all joking about Y2K, but actually, isn't this kind of scary, really, that we're all actually joking about the same thing and there is this kind of fear of the computers going down? Because when you look back at all the magazine articles from the late 90s, this was a really big concern, and
It
didn't happen.
Yeah.
But we spent billions of dollars trying to make sure it didn't happen. So, you know, it really could have gone the other way. And I think having that hangover, you know, the whole idea of the century changing, having that hangover your head for years and realizing that it's kind of this epochal thing that's going to happen, and at the same time we're just going through those late 90s, the growth of computers and the internet, and this whole feeling of just speeding ahead, and it's like wait, where are we going, like what's happening, like I think we all sort of felt like we've gotten a little ahead of ourselves, and Y2K sort of was kind of hanging over us all as like, well, maybe this is the big deadline that we don't know we're rushing toward.
Well, it's interesting because I remember on New Year's Eve 1999, I had some friends over to my apartment. We were just going to have like a quiet, you know, night. We weren't going to go out. I did not, get canned food and bottled water or anything like that. I was, I wasn't overly concerned. And then all my friends came over. We hung out, and once, Australia didn't blow up, we were like, okay, you know.
I think that was the general feeling. If Australia's okay, we're okay.
Right. And then as city by city went, and it just turned out to be just a pretty much uneventful, regular New Year's Eve. But it was a hell of a year at the movies. That last night. I mean, it had been a really heck of a year. Did you purposely set it up to do it in chronological order when you set up to write about these movies?
I think we kind of arrived at it toward the end, where we kind of changed the structure around a lot, because there's a lot of movies that you could sort of pull together thematically. I mean, in a weird way, you know, you can write about Fight Club and Office Space as sort of the same movie. You can link these movies that are all about these guys who are frustrated with their office jobs and want to escape. But we sort of felt like, myself and the editor at the end, were like, you know what, Y2K is, when you mention Y2K to people who were there, they instantly remember that feeling. And also, when you have a great story like David Fincher's about pulling an insane prank on Y2K, it's a little hard not to open up with that.
But
because that really captures the feeling. I mean, this was the year that was The Matrix and being John Malkovich and all these movies that were really asking these really big questions, but you sort of didn't realize until you walked out afterward, because you were like, boy, that's a really good movie. Then you were like, wait a minute, what was that movie trying to tell me?
Right.
There's tons of films like that year.
Yeah, it was really a pretty incredible year. So let's talk a little bit about the beginning of the year. And you the first movie that you write an essay about and interviews about is The Blair Witch Project, which was one of the many game changers of 1999. From the way that movie was marketed, which was the first movie that ever really took place or that really took advantage of the internet in its infancy. And just the way it was distributed and made, and what a phenomenon it became. Tell me about writing about Blair Witch.
Yeah, I started with Blair Witch because, you know, it debuted at Sundance in January of that year. And I think people sometimes think, oh, it was a big Sundance hit. But, you know, the Blair Witch Project was only bought for like $1 million, which back then in late 90s Sundance money actually wasn't a huge, huge, huge amount. And people didn't know what to make of it. I mean, for those who haven't seen it, you know, it's this found footage movie about these three filmmakers who go out in the woods and disappear. And you're seeing it all from these cameras that were supposedly found, this footage that was supposedly found. And it was made super quick. It was made super cheap. It was these two young filmmakers who really did put these three young actors in the woods for a little over a week and kind of torture them,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can kind of see in the performances. And, you know, people saw it at Sundance, and they were like, oh, interesting. But it wasn't until the Internet really started picking up on the Blair Witch, and these guys, Dan Merrick and Ed Sanchez, who directed the movie and wrote it, they had a lot of, they were very savvy about the Internet. And I don't think they even realized what they were doing. I mean, a lot of the Blair Witch was accidental, but what happened was they made this website before it even got to Sundance that was just this very kind of cheap-looking website with all these clues, and people, back then, there wasn't a social media to fact-check everything. So some people were really obsessed with the Blair Witch, and at one point, before it even came to Sundance, all these Blair Witch obsesses called this one big L.A. radio show and started asking them that they knew about the legend of the Blair Witch, and it took off from there. And, you know, by the time it came out in July, there was so much excitement and anticipation, and some people still didn't know that this was a fake documentary. And whether they wanted to believe or whether they really generally didn't know is kind of hard to tell. But, you know, by July, that movie was on the cover of Time and Newsweek at the same time, which is insane. I mean, that happens for, like, you know, that happens with Bruce Springsteen in the 70s. It does not happen with a tiny little indie movie made for five figures by two directors no one's ever heard of. And you know, that was a huge phenomenon that summer. You know, there was a little bit of a backlash afterward, but I don't know. I still think it. Have you watched it lately? I still think it actually holds up. I loved it when it came out.
I am so pro Blair Witch. I love that movie.
I loved it.
And I know that it's a divisive movie. I know a lot of people who absolutely hate it. But it was groundbreaking. I think it's scary as hell. It's got a terrifying final shot.
The final shot is insane.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Even people who hate it remember that final shot.
Yeah, and I'll tell you something. I mean, you're talking about how it became by the time summer rolled around, it was a phenomenon. And I specifically knew two people who thought it was real, and I had to tell them it's not real. It's fake. But I still think it holds up. I still think it's scary, and I think it's a game changer. And how many found footage movies have we seen now? I mean,
you know, there's been a lot. It took them a while because Paranormal Activity was kind of the first one that really copied it, and that was years afterward. And I think it really speaks to the fact that, like, the Blair Witch, from the way it was made to the way it was marketed on the Internet, it's really hard to copy that. That is such a singular phenomenon where how do you set off to make a movie that'll fool people like that, and then how do you sort of use the Internet to keep that going?
Yeah.
That's impossible to copy.
It is.
And I think, you know, I really enjoyed the first Paranormal Activity, but I didn't go in thinking, oh, is this real or not, which some people did with Blair Witch. I mean, that was a very different Internet back when you could still have some mysteries on the Internet.
Exactly. All right, Brian, hang on, okay?
Sure, yeah.
Brian Raftery is with us, and we are talking about his terrific book, Best Movie Year Ever, How 1999 Blew Up the Big Screen. 1999, considered one of the best movie years of all time. We're going to talk more about that right after we take a break for the news here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here until 5 a.m. It's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests and now one artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. We're going to remember the career of John Singleton, talk about him, and we've got the Impossible Burger that Burger King is going to release, and we're talking about some really, really weird fast food menu items that are available. But right now, we're talking about the movie year of 1999. The book is called Best Movie Year Ever, How 1999 Blew Up the Big Screen. Brian Raftery is the author. And we're talking about what a really game-changing year 1999 was at the movies. Brian, welcome back.
Hey, thanks again. This is great.
Yeah, so, you know, my producer Tom played that little song at the end. And, of course, the first thing that pops into my head now, it didn't used to be, is one of my favorite final shots in movie history, which is Fight Club. I read the book beforehand, and I've talked about this before. I never got to experience what it was like to find out who Tyler Durden really was, you know, because I knew I read the book.
Yeah.
So I'm always curious. Now, did you read the book before you saw the movie?
I hadn't read the book before I saw the movie, and I was just, it's so funny when you were playing that song. I mean, I still remember, I saw that on Friday night, on opening night in Manhattan, like in the Upper West Side, and I still remember like standing up while that music played and just turning to my friend and being like, this movie is too much. Like,
yeah.
I just felt pummeled.
Pummeled
by Fight Club in every way, and I couldn't watch it again for like a year.
Yeah.
It really, really, I mean, flipped my wig.
Yeah, no. I totally understand that, and I just love, I think it's like, personally, like that last scene, to me, is like one of the most romantic scenes in movie history. I adore that last scene. It's like the collapse of the world. The Pixies are playing, and then a big giant penis flashes on the screen. I was like, this is the greatest movie ending of all time. We're jumping around a little bit chronologically now, but Fight Club, sort of a revolutionary movie that again, as you said, Brian, was not a success when it was first released.
No, I mean, it was really, at the time, it was a toxic movie. I mean, you have to remember that it was supposed to come out in the summer, and in April, unfortunately, the events at Columbine High School happened
right.
in 1999, and everyone freaked out that, like, you know, all of a sudden this, you know, $65 million kind of gleeful, anarchic movie about guys going around and creating these really violent pranks was suddenly not funny anymore. And I think, you know, when it came out, I think people would have been offended by it anyway. I mean, it's a very, very dark movie. You know, Fincher and Edward Norton, who I spoke to for the book, they were both big fans of The Graduate, and I can see a through line, but I also think that those are very different movies tone-wise. They're both about angry young men and where they put that anger, but boy, Fight Club does not have a Mrs. Robinson kind of saltiness to it.
No.
So when it came out, you know, people, you know, there were devastating reviews. Rupert Murdoch was personally frustrated that his company, Fox, had made it. I mean, that scene that you mentioned where they blow up these credit card companies at the end, one of the buildings is actually one of Fox's downtown headquarters that they put in there. But, you know, that movie became, I was out of college at that point, but I've heard from many people that kind of became the dorm room poster you had in the same way that, you know, Pulp Fiction or Clockwork Orange was when I was in college. It was this very subversive, smart movie, and I understand also why people are totally offended by it, because there's stuff in Fight Club that's just like, it's just still kind of shocking to this day, and this whole idea of these really angry guys with all this rage and not knowing where to put it, and now we know that they put it on Twitter every day.
Right.
But, you know,
right.
I think for all the I think for all the rage in it, it's also very funny, and it has a lot to say about who we are in a very corporate controlled world. And you know, that movie is the end of that movie is the destruction of credit card companies because they want to change debt or, you know, annihilate debt, and boy, like 20 years later, that's a pretty relatable notion to a lot of people.
No.
Not the violent act behind it, but the idea of getting rid of debt. I mean, it's literally a presidential platform now.
It is. And that's a film and I think a book that was ahead of its time. And I just think I think Poloniak is like that as a writer. He's on the cutting edge of like everything that he writes is kind of like that. But it was it felt like a jolt. It felt like something new and something really risky. And there was an edge to it that a lot of movies didn't have. And the fact that it was a big budget film with, you know, a couple of big named actors in it was really said something because it felt, you know, edgy and not, you know, Hollywood at all.
Yeah, and I think that's why it couldn't, you know, I think the fact that it had Brad Pitt, and I think that the fact that it was directed by David Fincher, who'd just done Seven and The Game, these big hits, and the fact that Edward Norton, who was kind of this golden boy, who'd done these really cool movies back-to-back, the fact that it didn't open well was kind of a surprise.
Yeah.
And I think people really, I really think that the critics were out for this movie, and again, understandably, it was a tough watch in 99, but I think also people just were not in the mood to watch something that was really just going to sort of poke them in the kidney for 2.5 hours straight. I mean, it's an assaultive movie, and you have to kind of be with it in the first minute. Otherwise, you're going to be kind of torturing yourself for the next 2 hours.
Yeah, absolutely true. You know, you interviewed, you said more than 130 people for the book. Tell me about that process, because you talked, you know, for the Fight Club essay that you wrote, you talked to Norton and you talked to Fincher. How did you get some of these people, and what was it like to track them down and do the interviews?
You know, it's a lot of busy work, as I'm sure you know, to get these people. But, you know, I think the strange thing is it was easier than I thought Largely because I think a lot of the people involved with these movies recognized that year was special. I mean, I think there were very few people that I had to email and say, oh, by the way, here's all the movies I'm going to be talking about. Most of them kind of knew. I mean, most of them knew. You know, Entertainment Weekly that year put a cover story up in November of 99 saying this is the year to change movies, which is a pretty, pretty early call. But I think the filmmakers that year, because so many of them were around the same age, Steven Soderbergh and David Fincher and Kimberly Pierce and Alexander Payne, these were all people who were kind of friendly. You know, Spike Jones, David O. Russell or David Fincher is in Spike Jones as being John Malkovich. Spike Jones married Sofia Coppola that year. So a lot of them were very aware of what was going on in the culture. It was a lot easier to get them to talk about it, I think, once they realized that this year was really kind of special and that those kind of special years don't happen that often. You know, I think they all sort of recognize this is kind of a big deal. So it took a lot of messaging and talking to publicists and agents and managers, but it was great to be able to get all these people and get them. You know, Fincher gave me a lot of time, and he's not a guy who loves doing interviews. So even someone like him, it was kind of a testament. I think they're proud of Fight Club, and Norton and Fincher are smart enough about popular culture to realize that a movie like Fight Club coming out and kind of bombing and now becoming a classic, that's a great narrative. They know that. You know.
Yeah.
That makes it even cooler than if it had been a hit, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And now the idea for the book itself, Brian, it was just like it was obvious that you wanted to write something because 1999 was so special.
Yeah, I actually started. I really wanted to write about that year. I really wanted to write a big book about all the events of that year. Like, I really wanted to get into, you know, stuff like Columbine and Napster. And weird people forget this, but Donald Trump ran for president in 99, or at least he announced his first kid. So I wanted to write about all those things. And then my editor at Simon & Schuster just said, you know what, you can write about all these things or touch upon them, but you can do it through the lens of the movies, which was super exciting because I really, genuinely, that year has always been like, wow, that was the year where I saw at least two great movies a week.
Yeah.
I was seeing a lot of movies.
Yeah. It was great. And it's all reflected in the book, by the way, which is available. Just came out last week, correct?
Yeah, I think so. Week 2 weeks ago. I can't tell time anymore.
Okay,
but
I understand. All right. So Brian Raftery is the author. The book is called Best Movie Year Ever. And we're going to talk more about the movie year of 1999 after we take a break. Brian, hang on, okay?
You got it.
All right. Brian Raftery is with us. And we're going to talk some more about this great movie year of 1999. Okay, we'll be back after this.
It's not what you thought when you first began it. You got what you want.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock, and we were talking about the movies of 1999 with author Brian Raftery. The book is called Best Movie Year Ever, and it really, really was. And that song is from my favorite movie of all time, which came out at the end of 1999, and that's Magnolia. Let's bring Brian back. Brian, welcome back.
Oh, thanks so much.
Magnolia, that's my favorite movie ever. It is my favorite movie of all time, and I'm not exaggerating. I adore every frame of that movie. And that moment that we just played, that's a turning point in the movie. That's the point where you're either on board or you're not on board.
Mm.
And if you're on board, you'll buy the frogs. That's the way I feel about it, and I adore every frame of that movie. It's my favorite movie of all time. You interviewed some people involved in that one, and where do you stand on Magnolia?
Boy, I love that scene. I mean, that's the scene where all the characters at once start singing. For those who haven't seen it, it's funny. I use this phrase in the book, but to me, that's the moviest movie of 1999. It's Paul Thomas Anderson after Boogie Nights, which I absolutely love Boogie Nights. And, I mean, this is what movies were like in the late 90s, which is that a relatively young writer-director like that can go to New Line Cinema and basically say, you know, I want about $40 million, I want a final cut on a three-hour movie, and I want Tom Cruise, and you're all going to give it to me.
Yeah.
And
you've
got all of that. And I think for better or worse, it really is. You very rarely get a filmmaker that young, or even nowadays that experienced, getting to pour that much of his life and that many resources into an original idea. I really like Magnolia. It's tough when you're writing a book about these movies. You have to watch each one multiple times.
Yeah.
It was not always a fun movie to put on early in the morning before my kids got up. It's a lot about cancer and death.
Yeah.
But the thing I love about it, especially, is I love Tom Cruise, who's a very different movie star than he was in the '90s. He's someone I really always kind of dug his work and think he's kind of entertaining as a pop culture figure. And he makes these two movies in 1999. You know, one is Magnolia, and the other is Eyes Wide Shut,
right.
And they're just the two of the most, I mean, to me, those two movies are more daring than strapping yourself to the side of a helicopter.
Yeah, sure.
And I love the Mission Impossible movies, but man, I really, he was really going for it that year. I mean, it was probably the peak of his, you know, Hollywood star plus actor phase.
Yeah.
I don't think he's ever been better than those two movies. And his scenes in Magnolia, where he plays this skeezy, you know, pickup artist who is just completely dismantled over the course of a TV interview, where this amazing journalist played by April Grace, who's really wonderful, just takes apart all of his lies. It's extraordinary. It's like one of the best scenes. I don't know if Magnolia is in my top 10 of 1999, because there's a lot of movies I love more, and there's a little bit of flab to it, but boy, that scene where Tom Cruise is being just completely taken apart by the interviewer is definitely in my top three scenes for that year.
Yeah, I just love the fact that it's a movie that's really sort of unapologetic and shameless.
Yeah.
And I love everything about it. I love the length. I know that Paul Thomas Anderson is quoted as saying, "Shut up and cut 20 minutes," you know. But I love the fact that it as long as it is, and I just think it's just this beautiful over the top movie, you know, which is a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson's themes are, you know, trying to find a family and trying to fit in and trying to find loved ones and be a part of a family, and that's ultimately what this movie is about. But at the core of the movie is this character played by Melora Walters in an astonishing performance.
Yeah, she's great.
And that payoff at the end where she looks into the camera lens and finally smiles, and she smiles, it just kills me every time I see it. I get very emotional when I watch that movie, and it really hit me like a ton of bricks. So
it's so funny you mentioned that scene, because every time I rewatched it, when it would get a little long, and I was like, oh boy, I need to get it. That end scene does kind of not redeem it, but it really it does pay off. And I also think, you know, Julianne Moore has this remarkable meltdown in a pharmacy, which hilariously wound up on HBO's Barry last year.
I know.
As a monologue that Bill Hader or one of his friends, I can't remember, was doing. And I'm like, boy, this movie is just still in the culture. For a movie that came out and no one went to see, it does feel like it's still part of the culture in a big way.
Yeah. Other movies that I want to mention before we get you out of here. I can't explain to you how much I love Election.
It's my favorite movie that year. That's my Magnolia.
Oh, my God. That movie is so... And Alexander Payne just continues to make great... I know a lot of people hated Downsizing. I liked it. But I love Alexander Payne. I love his movies. Sideways is one of my favorite films of all time. But, boy, Election really just, like, knocked it out of the park.
Oh, yeah. It's so funny and so dark. And I think even in the last couple of weeks when I've been talking to people for this book, it's like people have forgotten about that movie and they're rewatching it now. And I feel like that movie was not a hit as well when it came out, like a lot of these big movies. And it's a really fun movie to rediscover. If you haven't seen Election, and if you watch it now, you'll swear it was made this year.
Absolutely.
It feels so spot on so many different topics.
And I don't think Reese Witherspoon has ever been better. You know, and I love Reese Witherspoon, but I think that's like her quintessential performance. I really do.
I really am a big fan of hers, but I do think that's certainly like a cornerstone for her, especially at that phase of her career.
Yeah.
Great in that. Matthew Broderick's fantastic in that too.
Yeah, he's great. He's great. And there's so many other movies that came out that year that were just like game changers. Man, The Matrix. I remember the first time I saw The Matrix, when it was over, I was just like, what was that? and I was just like, that was the coolest movie I've ever seen in my life. And I saw it again the next day.
Oh, wow.
but that was, look how influential that movie ended up being.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like you weren't the only person to walk out of that and want to see it again. And it's, what's amazing is that it's a movie about the Internet in some ways, that the Internet basically kept alive for that next 20 years. I mean, there's not a single day where someone does not come up with a new Morpheus GIF or a new Neo one-liner. I mean, people are still arguing about that movie and discussing it, and you can view that from a million... You can cut that movie up a million different ways and have a million different interpretations of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, you mentioned Being John Malkovich, another one that was just so crazy and so original. And I love the fact that John Malkovich is in it. I just think that that's, you know, like the fact that they got him to do it was, you know...
Oh, he's so funny is too. Yeah.
He's hilarious in it. I like when he gets hit on the head with the can, but which of course I guess wasn't planned. Is what I've heard is that.
Well, it's also one of those movies that, like, you know, Charlie Kaufman, who wrote that, he started working on it in the early 90s. A lot of the movies of that year, like The Matrix, were, you know, they were working on these films for years and years. And so when we were talking earlier about, you know, was it a coincidence that all these movies arrived in 1999? Yeah, it kind of is. But also, like, all these artists had their antennas up. They were kind of catching the same ideas about identity and where we're headed in technology. I mean, Being John Malkovich, to me, is just as much a movie about the internet as The Matrix is. I mean, it's about stealing someone's identity. It's very relatable now.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's we got to mention Three Kings. Another, yep. Man, what a great movie. So many great performances in that. David O. Russell really making a name for himself with that one. And that was a timely film, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, considering it came out, you know, it's this Desert Storm movie that comes out. It basically begins when the war ends. And it's all about, you know, it's this movie where George Clooney and Spike Jonze and Ice Cube go in the desert, and they kind of realize that all the U.S. foreign policy they've been swallowing in the early 90s was, in the late 80s, was completely kind of for naught. I mean, it's crazy. It's Warner Brothers, a huge American studio.
Yeah, absolutely.
Making a big budget movie about how the U.S. government has failed us in the Middle East, which, like, and it's also an action movie and also a comedy and just like a remarkably fun movie. That is a movie that I think you would never get made in 2019. Maybe not in any medium. It's a little too dangerous.
I agree. I totally agree. And it's so incredibly entertaining.
It really is.
All the way through. Well, we can't not mention it. I'd rather not, but we have to mention Episode One, The Phantom Menace, came out in 1999. I mean, it was, you know, obviously, people waited for years and years and years for that movie to come out, and it did make a huge impact. And I mean, it was a cultural thing that happened in 1999.
It was, and you know, it's interesting. I am not in this generation, but I am certainly very aware that the younger generation for whom that movie has been redeemed. And I think even if you do hate the film, and I've watched it a lot of times, and I've tried to love it, and I can only begrudgingly admire certain parts of it, but there is some stuff to admire. But even if you really hate it, I mean, that movie, of all the movies that year, that was kind of showing where we were going. I mean, it's like, you know, we were not doing a lot of sequels in 1999. There were only a few of them, and this movie comes along, and if it weren't for Titanic, it would have been the biggest movie of the 90s, and all of a sudden the studios are like, oh, you can take a 13-year-old franchise or whatever, 17 years old, and reignite it? Let's do that. You know, yeah. I think that sort of showed that IP, that big IP and big franchises is going to be a studio priority going forward.
Yeah. Well, listen, Brian, the book is great, man.
I really appreciate it.
I loved it, and you got so many great people to talk to you on this. You cover the year beautifully, and you succeeded in writing a book about that year through the eyes of cinema, and it's a terrific book, and it brought me right back to 20 years ago. So,
oh, that makes me happy. Thanks so much, Nick. I appreciate it.
Okay, man. Take care.
You too.
All right, Brian Raftery, who is the author of Best Movie Year Ever, a terrific book. How 1999 blew up the big screen. 20 years ago, some of the best movies ever made all came out in the same year, and this book chronicles that, and it's a great one. So, we have a link on our Facebook page if you want to check it out. It's available now, and I highly recommend it. Okay, we'll take a break and be back after this on 720 WGN.